Hello, I'm Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, economic historian Petra Moser looks at the impact of early 19th century patent and copyright laws on innovation and creativity, using the Italian opera as a model for one.
What we observe is really interesting is that these states with copyrights produce more operas, but they also produce better operas.
The effects of copyright and patent laws on artistic creativity and technological innovation are gaining more and more significance today in the context of protecting intellectual property. Petra Moser uses data from world fairs in the 1800s and of Napoleon's military victories in Italy to examine the economic implications of basic copyright and patent protection for innovators. Petra Moser is an economic historian at New York University and was invited by the IMF's Institute for Capacity Development to present her research.
How important do you think innovation and creativity are in economics?
Creativity and innovation are giving us really most of the things that we consume today. So I don't think we could really live without creativity and innovation. So even things that you may think are not as essential to our survival, say songs or books or movies, make people happy. And so I think it's incredibly important.
And they drive the economy.
Yes. Yeah, it's a big part of our economy today is driven by content, and that is driven by creativity.
And so you've been studying the ways innovative people have been able to protect their ideas. Mm-hmm. The World Fairs in the mid-1800s was the focus of one of your research papers. Mm-hmm. What did those world fairs tell you about how new ideas are developed?
What they told me was that there is a lot of innovation that occurs in the absence of patents. So the key benefit of data that I collected from exhibition catalogs is that these data make visible innovation in countries without patent laws. But what we also observe is that in a country that does not have a patent system, the inventor will just focus on a small set of industries.
Can you give me an example of perhaps one innovation that may have come out of those fairs in the mid-1800s?
So one of the most famous inventions that were presented at the Crystal Palace Fair was the Reaper. And it was an American machine to reap on a broad area of land. It actually looks fairly simple, but it's ingenious. And it's an example of one of these inventions that Europeans just did not think that the Americans were capable of. So the Americans really surprised European observers, because before the fair, Europeans had thought of the United States as a backwater. And they had thought that the next technological leader would be France or Germany. And then out of nowhere comes the United States. And one of those inventions was the Reaper.
And do you think that the success of the United States of coming up with these innovative ideas was their patent system? Like, did their patent system exist at that time?
They did have a patent system. And I think that the patent system is, again, more important for some types of innovations than for others. So it will be very important for an inventor of a new reaping equipment or an inventor of a new type of manufacturing machinery to be protected by a patent, because at this period in time, if I show you my new reaper, you can actually fairly easily reverse engineer it. Whereas if I show you a dye that I just developed, it can't really do anything. Say, indigo is incredibly valuable at the time.
Indigo, the color.
Yes. But nobody could really reverse engineer it until much later, until the late 19th century. And it wasn't for lack of trying. So they would really try to reverse engineer these dyes, but they really couldn't because science had not yet caught up. So a die, I would not protect with a patent. But for something like a Reaper, you really need a patent. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why the U.S. was so good at developing manufacturing machinery. So I think overall, the effect of having a patent system is much more towards changing the nature of what gets invented rather than changing the number of inventions. Because, say, if an institution isn't perfect and you have an imperfect patent system, creative people will find a way to protect their innovations in some other way.
Like, what other types of mechanism is there that could do that?
Secrecy is one of the more effective mechanisms, effective alternatives to patents. Say, if I live in a country without effective patent protection, or even if I can't afford to take out a patent or to defend my patent, I may just choose to keep my invention secret. So I just don't share the knowledge that would be required to reverse engineer that invention.
But are you not, if we're talking about things that encourage innovation and creativity, what you just described there, does that not work against that?
Yes. I think if I keep something secret, then I'm not sharing that invention. And that means that the next generation can't build on the knowledge that I've created. So access to existing knowledge really matters a lot for building new knowledge, for creating new knowledge.
You also describe some patent systems in some countries favoring systems that favor some groups over others. To what extent do you think that patent systems can become more about politics than about science?
I think that's a risk with any type of intellectual property, that if I invest a lot of money into developing an invention and I realize that it would really help me to have longer terms of protection for that invention, then at some point as a businessman, I probably make the calculation, well, maybe now it's worth it for me to go and influence some politician. So that's where lobbying comes in. As an empirical economist, that makes it very, very hard for me to disentangle cause and effect, which is why it's usually frustrating. But I think it is a fact of life.
So the other thing that you look at very closely in your research is copyright, as you mentioned earlier. And you use the Italian opera as a model. Why the Italian opera?
Honestly, I just thought it was interesting. But then as we did the research, I realized it's actually a very good measure for innovation because opera is a very public form of art. So if somebody writes a new opera, we'll have a record of it. And then we'll also know how successful that opera was because somebody will write about it. So it's very observable how successful an opera was. And then in this particular case of Italian opera, what it allows us to do, it allows us to circumvent the problem that lobbying might drive changes in patent laws, or changes in this case in copyright law. What we exploit here is variation in the timing of Napoleon's military victories in Italy. So Napoleon invades Italy and is successful in some places and not so successful in others. And by 1801, a part of Italy, the part of northern Italy, has come under French control, Lombardy and Venetia, and they get all French laws, including the French copyright law. Then Napoleon continues to take over the rest of Italy, but that occurs after 1804. Importantly, in 1804, the French Parliament adopts the Code Civil, which is agnostic on copyright laws. It says, if you already have them, you can keep them. But if you don't have copyright laws, we don't really know whether it's good or bad, so we're just not going to give any country new copyright laws. That creates a situation in which only part of Italy gets copyright laws. So two states get copyright laws and six states don't. So now we can look at what happens to compositions and what happens to the output of operas in the states that have copyrights and compare it with those that don't have copyrights.
And so are those states with copyright laws more creative or more innovative?
What we observe is really interesting is that these states with copyrights produce more operas. But they also produce better operas, and better in the sense of operas that are more immediately popular because we can measure it. So we know when there's a really like hit show of an opera, and also operas that are more durable. So these are, they're more likely to produce operas that we still listen to today. So both of those are some measures of quality. They're not perfect measures of aesthetic quality, which I think is really, really hard to judge, but they tell us how economically valuable these operas were. And so with copyright, the composer gets to keep some of the profits of having an opera that plays over and over again. So now we're creating an incentive for somebody to create an opera that's very durable.
And do you think that just the fact that these two states had copyright laws, that it attracted people who are writing operas to go to that state because it would be advantageous for them?
We do observe that composers from other parts of Italy go to Lombardy and Venetia and premiere operas there. So they create the opera in Lombardy and Venetia and premiere it there, and then they actually get copyrights in Lombardy and Venetia. But what we don't see is that there's not a differential decline in output from the other states. So it's not like this thing drains other Italian states of their composers. It seems more like that there are now more people who are staying in Italy and producing their operas there rather than going abroad, going to France or like Austria at that time.
So there's another element that I thought was interesting is infrastructure, because we talk a lot about infrastructure these days, you know, in terms of trying to help, especially in the developing world, countries develop their economies through building infrastructure. But infrastructure, it seems, had a role to play in those countries in Italy where operas were successful. Talk to me a little bit about that.
So generally, data on Italy, say data on Italian GDP, number of people in this period that we're studying, which is around 1801, are very, very bad. What we have really good data on, though, is theaters. So we not only know the number of theaters, but we also know how many seats were in each theater, which is a very nice measure for demand for new operas. So essentially, if I have a theater with lots of seats, then there's more demand in that state. So what we do is we look at whether places with a better pre-existing infrastructure benefit more from the adoption of copyright. And that's precisely what we find, is that the effect of copyrights is not homogeneous. It benefits more those places that have a better pre-existing infrastructure and as a proxy for demand. So if you have more demand for a cultural good and that area gets copyrights, there's going to be a bigger increase in output.
So in the end, do you think that innovation and creativity is given enough consideration in our economics today?
I think there's a lot of research on patents, but there isn't enough research yet on copyrights. And that is an area in which more economists should do research, in my opinion, because it's so important and it's only going to get more important over time. And we just need empirical evidence to look at the effects of copyrights on creativity.
Petra Moser is an economic historian at the Stern School of Business at New York University. You can find her research papers on the economic impact of creativity and innovation at petramoser.net. Moser was invited by the IMF's Institute for Capacity Development. Go to imf.org to learn more about the Institute's knowledge sharing and online training opportunities. And if you like this podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.